two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy 2024! New year, new you, right? Let me guess. You're thinking about joining a new gym, starting a fad diet, buying that Theragun everyone's always yammering on about. I've got a better idea. Listen to my podcast. I'm Samantha Bee, writer, comedian, and host of Choice Words from Lemonada Media. This whole month of January, we're going to help you make better choices in 2024. We'll go beyond superficial hacks and get at the truth of how to lead a more meaningful life. Just search for Choice Words on your podcast player of choice and hit follow so you don't miss an episode. Now that is a good choice. Lemonada.
In the great entrance hall to the Hubert Humphrey Building, that's the headquarters where CMS is, where I worked, chiseled on the wall of the great hall in massive letters are the words of Senator Hubert Humphrey, which he spoke at the dedication of that building in his name. He said, "The moral test of government is how it treats people in the dawn of life, the children, the twilight of life, the aged, and in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped." I think this is the moral test of professions as well. These among us in the shadows, they don't speak, not loudly. They often don't vote. They don't contribute to political campaigns or PACs. They employ no lobbyists. They write no op-eds. We pass by their coin cups outstretched, as if invisible, on the corner as we head for Starbucks. And Congress passes them by, too, because they don't vote and campaigns cost money. And if those in power do not choose of their own free will to speak for them, the silence descends. This is what I learned in Washington.
Welcome to In the Bubble. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Wachter. You've just heard the graduation speech at Harvard Medical School in 2012. The speaker was Dr. Don Berwick, who we will hear from today. When I went to med school about 100 years ago, we learned how to be a doctor, but we learned absolutely nothing, as I think back, about how to improve the system that we were working in. And it struck me through my entire career as a practicing physician and as an administrator, how big a gap that was. That, you know, we now understand that being a good doctor or a good nurse or a good pharmacist involves not only the way that you take care of individual patients, but if you work in a dysfunctional system, you can be terrific in the one-on-one care of people, and yet the outcomes that patients have are not going to be what we all hope for. So one of the important evolutions in healthcare generally, and medicine particularly over the last couple of decades, is a deepening appreciation of the role of what we call systems thinking, that the things that go into whether patients get the care that they need and do as well as they can do are not only how good the individual doctor is in one-on-one with a patient, but also whether the system functions effectively. There is no one in the universe who has done more to promote that understanding and to taking that understanding and approaching it in practical ways to make the healthcare system better. There's no one who has had more of an impact on that than our guest today, Dr. Don Berwick. Don is truly the international leader in the fields of patient safety and healthcare quality. He's the founding director of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, which is the most influential improvement organization in healthcare in the world. As COVID has unfolded, I've been struck by the number of lessons that I learned from the safety and quality field that have now been applied to COVID. You may have heard of the Swiss cheese model, the idea that, you know, we only get it right when all the different layers come together. That's something that was first introduced in healthcare in the field of patient safety. You know, how do medical errors happen and how do we prevent them? We've talked about the virtue of simplicity, particularly in the vaccine rollout, the importance of teamwork, the importance and increasing appreciation of the importance of equity and social and socioeconomic determinants of health, that, as has been often stated, that your zip code is more to do with your ultimate longevity and healthcare outcomes than your genetic code. These are concepts that for some people are being introduced to them for the first time in COVID, but really were introduced in healthcare over the last 20 or 30 years, and many of them by Don Berwick. After finishing his stint with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, Don went to Washington for several years, where he was the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That's the same organization that Andy Slavitt ran a few years ago. Don was the administrator of that organization at the time the Affordable Care Act was rolling out, the first couple of years of the Obama administration. So he learned a lot about the ways of Washington. Not all of the lessons were pleasant. But he was as responsible as anyone for getting the ACA through the sausage factory. And it, obviously, it's been incredibly important in helping patients get the care that they need. So in the last few years, Don has come back to working with his institute, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, and has also remained a crucial thought leader in the areas of improving healthcare generally and has applied that thinking to COVID. So he'll be talking to us about some of the lessons of COVID, some of the lessons from his career before that, and how we think about healthcare improvement in the context of this pandemic. So with that, I really look forward to talking to Don Berwick. Let us ring him up. Don Berwick, we're thrilled to have you. Thank you for being on today.
It's my pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Don, you've had a central role in improving healthcare through your own work and that of your the organization you founded, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, IHI. And it's largely from taking lessons from other industries about how to improve quality and to achieve excellence and importing them into healthcare. One of the key epiphanies from your work, at least for me, was that it wasn't just about the excellence of the individual clinician, whether it was a doctor, a nurse, pharmacist. It was also about how well the system works. How important was this concept to you, and how did you address the messaging? Since most people probably thought that bad outcomes or medical errors were the result of flawed human beings.
And that's how I was trained, that excellence came from heroism and dedication and professionalism and effort. And that when things went wrong, somebody let it down. And sometimes that happens. There are people who shouldn't be doctors or who are doing things that are miscreants of some form. But almost everything that you want to make better is not made better by heroism. That's what I began to learn. The whole idea is to develop a system in which average people can perform spectacularly. And that requires designs around them that are highly supportive and help people get what they need. It's also important to have an external focus. Equality in the modern world is not defined through the eyes of the professionals, defined through the eyes of the beneficiary, the patient, the family, the community. And that whole externalization of the definition is a very, very important idea. It was a change. It was a change for me. I spent many nights up in my 36 on, 12 off, training agenda, training eras, thinking that if I just did everything right, it would come out right. And that isn't true. It isn't true. And Bob, you were there ahead of most people yourself as you conceived of what it would be like to develop the hospitalist community. You were a systems thinker at that point, and it is disruptive, but it's also a relief, because to be a doctor or a nurse or a pharmacist and believe that If everything depends on you being perfect, that's a formula for a pretty sad and unsuccessful life.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember having read some of your work in the mid to late 90s and then walking out of my office into my hospital, and it almost felt like I was wearing new glasses. You know, all of the flaws, they were just everywhere. And this is arguably one of the best hospitals in the world, and yet so many things went wrong. And it became obvious that if you were dependent on people being perfect, if that's your safety system, that's a cruel joke, not only on the patients, but on the clinicians themselves. It just can't work.
The softer side of it, I also believe, is that people are trying. They want to be. Dr. W. Edwards Deming used to say, trying harder is the worst plan. But he also said that almost everyone wants to be proud of their work. They want to feel good about what they've done. And so you can harness energy and intelligence and perceptions and efforts. It's there. It's there for the asking, but not through exhortation or blame. It's done by invitation to change work together.
Why was healthcare so late to this understanding? You mentioned that you didn't invent a lot of these techniques. They were already well known in other industries.
In those days, yeah, I think healthcare has gone on and done a lot of pioneering work about systems, but in those days it was imported. I don't know. It's been canonical to say that it's the three industries that really resisted modern approaches to making things better have been education, healthcare, and government. And it's in those three, I don't know. In healthcare, one of the culprits is fragmentation. Just the whole thing, the way the whole thing got set up with highly separate disciplines, financial systems that encourage a very local thinking. We've cut it into more and more pieces, and you just don't get excellence from pieces. You get excellence from connections. And it's also hard. You know, healthcare is quite complicated, and you can't just take, things you learn by putting together a good computer or a good toaster and say, okay, let's now put that in healthcare. No. There have to be a lot of adaptations. Also, tensions and emotions are very high in healthcare. This is something people care deeply about. And so even as simple a thing as recognizing when something goes wrong has an affective, emotional, super ego component to it that's very hard to deal with. If you actually believe it's your fault, then it's hard to say things go wrong, even if they are. So opening eyes, which you've done brilliantly in your work, Bob, is a threshold that's a little hard to cross in healthcare.
You mentioned the Institute of Medicine report on medical mistakes, which came out in late 1999. It was sort of the beginning of the modern patient safety era, and to some extent, the beginning of the modern improvement era, where people kind of got the idea that it's mostly about systems. One of the things that was most distinctive about that report was an analogy. I don't know if you were the source of it or someone else in the group, but here it came out and it said 44,000 to 98,000 people are dying a year from medical mistakes. And that might have made it to page 7 of the newspapers. Back then, we had these things called newspapers. But then it went on and said that would be the equivalent of a jumbo jet crashing every day. Where did that come from, and why was it so important to get the communication right? We'll start making some connections to COVID in a second, but I have in mind the relatively poor job we've done in communicating some complicated things over the past year. So that seemed like a really impressive analogy that really turned things quite a bit.
It was frighteningly serendipitous, but you're right. The way the story gets told matters a ton. So Janet Corrigan deserves credit, I think, for the 44,000 to 98,000 calculation, which she did late one evening, just before the report came out, actually, but before the report got put into final form, based on the Colorado and Utah study and the Harvard Medical Practice study. And those were very tragic, charismatic numbers. I think it was Lucian Leap who offered the analogy to the jumbo jet crashes. But you are right. You know, it's not enough just to have the facts. They have to be put in a form that people can notice and remember.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts, behind-the-scenes segments, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through all of our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Let's talk about one more part of your past history before we move on to COVID. So early in the days of the Obama administration, you were asked to become the administrator of CMS, of Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Just make the point that Andy Slavitt, who normally hosts this podcast, that was his former job as well in the government. So you took it. It struck me that, you know, having run IHI for a long time, this was very, very different than anything you'd ever done before. So what did you think you were getting yourself into, and what were the lessons over the next 18 months that you learned that you didn't really understand?
It was a complete surprise. I got a call from Senator Tom Daschle, who at the time was going to be the secretary designate, and he and I had had some interactions around what could be possible if government got organized around quality and improvement as a fundamental strategic agenda. And then the Affordable Care Act began to be born, and he asked if I would accept a nomination from the president to head CMS, which I thought hard about and decided to do. The possibility of scaling improvement with such large lever was very attractive. I've always felt there were four tests to any policy change. One is, can we get toward healthcare as a human right? Can we improve quality? Can we improve the social determinants of health and illness? And can we reduce costs? And the methods that I had become familiar with and used at IHI thought could work at scale. It was quite thrilling. And, of course, the Affordable Care Act offered traction on the first, which is moving toward healthcare as a human right. So it was a stunningly interesting opportunity for me, and I felt very privileged. I was a little concerned about moving from a small organization to such a large one. And I knew that the atmosphere would be very charged politically, as indeed it was. It was the best experience of my professional life overall, although I must say it was a difficult political, you know, the politics were hard, but the opportunities were massive. The energy in the government to try to get healthcare where it should be was probably at a level that may not have been there before. And what I discovered to my joy was the workforce. There were 5,500 people working in CMS who had not had a fully empowered administrator. Everyone else had been acting. I was not acting. I was a recess appointee, but I was the full administrator for 6 years. And I went there and just began talking about the triple aim, better care, better health, and lower cost as the goals that the organization, I said, would be a major force and a trustworthy partner for the continual improvement of health and healthcare for all Americans. That was the strapline. And I just told them what I thought was the potential. And then the Affordable Care Act had so many tools in it to help make care better. Most people think of it primarily as a coverage law. It is. There are 10 titles, and I'd say about five of them are about coverage, but the other five are about quality. So there's a lot in there to make care better. And it was just so resonant. It's so exciting to discover this workforce that just wanted to help. It was an amazing experience for me. My learning curve was vertical, learning how to prepare regulation or to guide a sub-regulatory guidance document or to work with the White House or work with Congress was all is something I had to learn, but I had superb backup and the support was phenomenal. So it was a wonderful experience, Bob. I wish I could have stayed, but the appointment was a recess appointment. And at that point, Congress was so fractionated that there was no way that we're going to confirm any significant Obama appointment. But it was quite an amazing experience.
It's wonderful to hear you say that. I have to say there were times where I watched you in a congressional hearing, for example, and just felt terrible for you, knowing how amazing an individual you are, and to see the partisanship and the way you were grilled with silly, you know, everything about scoring points have nothing to do with substance. How did you deal with that?
Oh, a couple of ways. One is what you couldn't see is the amount of support I had from the administration and from my staff and others who were saying, okay, Senator such and such is going to ask you this. Here's some background. I was very well supported and prepared. I cared deeply about the work and the job, and that's where the meaning is. And you're right. A lot of the very partisan attacks were, to say the least, ill-informed. Sometimes they were lies. Sometimes they were just total misconceptions. And I dealt with it, like deal with the rain, you know, it's falling. So that's going to happen. But Bob, you know, the amount, what you got, what I got to do in that position, helping people in institutions finally get to homes where instead of institutional care to work on really important efforts in patient safety, to try to get 20 million people health coverage, to establish, you know, a whole culture within the organization, in which the self perception was of a public health agency, something where they really could help and work. It made the noise sort of go away. And, you know, I didn't welcome the attacks. They were deeply ill-informed. And one of the disappointments was the lack of an ability at that level of polarization to actually have a civil, respectful dialogue. You know, that simply wasn't what people seemed to be interested in, at least in the opposition at that time.
Yeah. Hasn't gotten better is my perception.
I don't know.
So let's pivot to COVID. Let's start sort of at 35,000 feet and then we'll drill down. What are the lessons from the past year that you take away from COVID that, you know, maybe things that you didn't fully understand or that have really become crystal clear in the past year to all of us?
I guess on the positive side, we've learned we can move very fast. The pace of change in delivery has been stunning and good. And I think, you know, it's an industry that doesn't make change like that fast, that well. Here we are moving knowledge around the planet at a pace I've never seen before. And I think committing to a kind of form of standardization that I also value, which is instead of everybody saying, I do it my way, you know, this is my autonomy, people are being curious about who knows something I don't know and what have they learned in Italy or Wuhan or wherever that I could use here in my town. So I think that the move towards science-based, evidence-based care has been vibrant in the professions. It hasn't been in the White House, to say the least, but that's going to change now. But I think we made COVID told us facts help, facts matter. I personally believe the move to virtual care is very good. I actually would defer in all respects to you, Bob, given your scholarship on this. But I you know, we have talked about digital care, virtual care for a long time. Not had much of it. Now we have a ton of it. And I think it's going okay. I think we're going to have to grapple with some issues around cost. I think the parity pricing, for example, needs to be very strongly reconsidered. That's a good short-term solution. But what is the proper price and cost structure for a virtual care system? I've had 3 medical encounters myself in the past few weeks. Nothing serious, but stuff I needed. And it was all virtual, all perfect, all immediate. I got team-based care. It was great. So that's a good lesson. And embedded in that is something we haven't really looked at yet, which I'd love to hear your thoughts about, Bob, and that is the care we didn't need. That is, people didn't show up for stuff they did need, but they also didn't show up for stuff that it turns out they didn't need at all. And if we're smart, we'll be able to get it overuse. On the downside, we weren't prepared. We were rated as prepared as a nation, the highest rating possible from the UN rating, preparedness rating scores of the mid part of the decade. But man, we were caught on our heels, not even to mention the poor execution in the prior administration. So we're going to have to reconsider what preparedness means and hopefully learn from this. Equity is the big thing here, which is people of color, communities that are isolated, incarcerated people, people of disadvantage got hit a heck of a lot harder. Part of our action is, well, duh, you know, that's been going on for a century.
Yeah, right.
COVID just makes it more evident, but it's been there. But maybe this is a time when we're going to finally face the music on this one or do something about it. And so it's a terrible, terrible need that we need that reminder, but we've got the reminder. One area that I know is not popular politically, but I care a lot, is criminal justice. If you watch what's been happening in our prisons and jails, it is terrible and remediable. And maybe we'll wake up to that. So there's a reckoning. And then last is the workforce, where we kind of let it down. You know, obviously, lack of N95 masks and equipment, that's part of it. But there's much, much deeper issue here about what the workforce is, who they are. And a lot of vulnerable people in healthcare who don't happen to have MD after their names or RN and getting paid, in some cases, minimum wage, they're the workforce too. And they were left exposed in a way that we really can't allow in the future. So some good news, a lot of open questions and some things we have to reckon with.
Yeah. Do you think the issue of inequities, and I know you've focused a lot on this over decades, Is it exposed now because COVID was so visible, or is it exposed because of the confluence of George Floyd and similar acts at the same time COVID hit? In some ways, it's a coincidence of these two pillars hitting at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, you could think of other guests you could have that would know more than me about it. I think the George Floyd murder and Breonna Taylor and the others, they did make a difference. There was something about that timing and the Black Lives Matter movement that hit a spot where we got more alerted, more aware. You know, those of us in the scholarship of health were aware for a long, long time, but the public, is, I think, was reminded. The data, the numbers in COVID are so asymmetric that it also makes it hard to ignore especially for African Americans, to Latinx at some point, to some degree, and also very importantly, Native Americans, who really, really they're having a very hard time. So you're right, the numbers are consistent. We'll see if this does outlast the pandemic. I hope it does. I hope we're going to say, now we're going to invest. And as I said, the science is there. I often lecture and quote from Sir Michael Marmot's amazing book, which I'd recommend to any of your listeners, the book, The Health Gap, which was a turning point book for me, appeared in 2015. And Marmot's book, The Health Gap, it digested really a century of research on disparities, and then made it orderly, like, well, what is this? What's doing this? And he has his categories. You know, it's the education and experience of young children. It's the vibrancy of education systems. It's conditions in the workplace, especially generous conditions of minimum wage, so people have incomes they can really not just live on, but thrive on. It's elder care, whether society's systematic about it. And it's community infrastructures like transportation, housing, food security, criminal justice, recreation. These all matter a ton. And those are the social determinants. That's what's making us sick or not. And COVID underlines every single one of them. So why now? I don't know. But certainly the racial side of this has come forward. To get through it, to get into a better place, Marmot would challenge us that we have to reconsider values, that there's a sense of solidarity and community and interdependence and kind of caring for each other that has to be foundational to working on the true causes of illness and injury and disability and suffering. And if we can discover that among us, we stand a chance. If we don't stand a chance.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
As you think of the stage we're at now with COVID, the vaccines being out, and you see the way that has been playing out, what's your take on it? Is it just the sort of last vestiges of the competence problem under the last administration? Do you think we're going to get on top of the vaccine issue?
Well, the level of neglect, incompetence, even sabotage of what would have been the proper kind of public health 101 response when the pandemic began, that is very damaging. It's not going to, the damage is not going to go away immediately. So a lot of this, I still think, has to do with the fact of how high and dry we were left as a nation with respect to vaccines, testing, surveillance. We have to see what the deck of cards, what the hand was dealt. I would say, well, I'm not just pleased, but quite thrilled by the people that President Biden appears to have drawn around him to try to solve the problem, not least of which is Andy Slavitt himself. But there, if you look at the roster of people that he's brought together to try to work on it, it's good. It's really good. Science back in the proper position. He's elevated the presidential science advisor position itself to a cabinet level, which has never been done before. That's a spectacularly good idea. I think the logistics of the vaccines, as we try to work out the state-federal relationships and the supply chain issues, that's very hard work. But I think I see the people in place who can do that. Good leadership now for CDC, and probably CDC land will be honored instead of criticized. And we'll rejoin the world community, because there's a lot of help and advice and guidance we can get by learning from other countries, even as we help them. So I'm optimistic. The results aren't in hand yet. We still have ways to go. And this virus is for 15 genes. It's pretty darn clever, I'll tell you, this thing. It's formidable enemy. And you know, I'm worried now about, you know, what could happen, immune escape or a variant. But now with science back in the front seat, and with the kind of competence of the people I see assembled, I think we will succeed. We will succeed. And I worry a lot about other countries, and especially the global South, who don't have the resources we've got to throw at this. And I hope this administration is able to find the political leverage and political will to say, yes, we need to save our country, but we live in a world in which we're interdependent and have responsibilities too. So I think our job is also to make sure the vaccines become available to those countries and people who are going to need some help to get them, for example. So I hope that's on the table.
Yeah. In a recent New Yorker article, you were quoted as saying, command and control is never going to work in America. And it's an interesting comment in that there's a lot of criticism for the lack of federal control and coordination for the last 4 years. So how do you see that balance between what the federal response needs to be, but also that comment about command and control?
Well, it's like anything in quality. You can have wonderful concepts, and we do need those. We need a CDC that's strong. I'm not sure I'd say the word would be commanding, but have gravitas and expertise and be trustworthy. We need a president who says, let's take this hill. You do need leadership. We absolutely need it, and we've lacked it to our terrible disadvantage. But as you know, in our world, Bob, in the quality world, when you finally get to the last mile where people have to use the knowledge and be supported to do that, it's a locale-by-locale thing to do. The way we'll get 100% vaccination in this country will come down to a granularity of individual communities that feel empowered. They feel able to be creative and to do their work. And that's sort of what I meant by that quote. It meant, you know, this is an enlistment, an engagement problem as much as it is a be smart enough to have the right answer problem. So it's a both and. Mm-hmm. And yes, I'd say if I had to say what we lacked most in the prior 4 years and in the COVID early first year of the pandemic, it was leadership. It was direction, leadership, priorities. Take that hill.
Yeah. I want to ask you about two things we've mentioned already, but I sort of love you to project how it's going to go in the future. We've talked about health inequities and social determinants of health. And as you said, this is a moment where they're receiving the attention that they should have always received, but really are receiving it now. And the second is preparedness in the public health system. And in both cases, it feels like everybody's saying the right thing, but I wonder about whether we really will turn the battleship around. There are some forces in both accounts that make it hard to do, hard to resource them appropriately. In the case of preparedness, hard to sustain it. It's a piggy bank that often gets raided when times are tight. So how do you think about both of those issues? And are you hopeful about the future for them? Or you think that this may be sort of during the pandemic, sure. But after the pandemic goes away, we may begin to neglect them again.
I try to be optimistic and stay hopeful. With respect to inequity, disparities, which aren't just in health, but they are in health. I served on the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force. When President Biden locked up the nomination, he and Bernie Sanders had an agreement to set up six task forces to come up with consensus policy statements in six areas, immigration, environment, criminal justice, education, economy, and healthcare. And Senator Sanders appointed three and Biden five to each of those. So I was a Sanders appointee to the healthcare Unity Task Force, which meant I spent about 2 months in very detailed and extensive efforts to try to reconcile things. we came together around a recommendation that I deeply believe in, which is that the equity issues in this country need to be dealt with what I call an all-of-government approach. Whether a young, vulnerable kid is going to live a full life or an impoverished family is going to find a way out of poverty, it doesn't belong to any department. There's no single effort. It's a shared network of activities from the government's point of view. And therefore, we urge that then President-elect Biden, now President Biden, might consider a sort of Oval Office initiative, an all-of-government initiative led from the White House to say to every single cabinet department and all the willing private sector stakeholders, let's close these gaps. We're going to do this together, and everyone's got a role to play, no bystanders, and we're going to end up with a nation with no hungry child, no family without a home, no incarcerated person without a route back to society. You know, well, let's pick some of these social determinants and work on them. I still believe that's the right thing to do. I'm sure President Biden's a very busy man. He's got a lot on the table, but I hope that maybe we'll see a sort of White House-led effort around equity that will be multi-year and continue even from this administration to another. If that happened, I would be very hopeful. We have the resources. We're spending more on equity now than we would have to if we actually came together and made it a national goal. With respect
whether the public health system and preparedness.
Public health, yeah. It's sort of harder because we have so much to do now that to be truly prepared for any threat is going to be really hard. That's an engineering problem. Can we come together as a country and figure out what the clever way to be ready? Ready not just to get rid of COVID, but ready for the next virus, ready for the grid to go down, ready for bioterrorism, ready for a cyber attack. There's plenty of documentation. I chaired a National Academy of Medicine committee at workshop series the year before COVID on preparedness. Our finding was we're not prepared. But we can do it. We have some actually great thinking going on in this country about regional preparedness, and that's going to be – it's going to take some really serious design work. It's very hard, technically possible. We have good models, so I guess I'm optimistic about that too. And we could do both. But, you know, Bob, if we don't find a way to close these enormous gaps in well-being in our country, from the haves to the have-nots, from the richest to the poorest, it's going to be really hard to get the rest of the work done. So that's the thing that's on my mind most right now.
How's this past year been for you, Don? I know you have a big family and children, grandchildren. How have you dealt with it personally, and what are you most looking forward to as we pull ourselves out of this thing?
Hugging my grandchildren is what I look forward to. you know, it's been the same preps as for you. I feel so lucky. How lucky could I be? You know, I'm safe in a home. I don't have to worry about food or income, and my wife with me. We're living in the mountains, so we have a weekend home in New Hampshire. We've moved here, and I've been here for a year because it's a safe, very safe place to be. The price of that, personally, of course, has been much less contact with my four children and eight grandchildren. And I miss it desperately, but I understand what we have to do. Every time I get to be with a friend now, because circumstances allow, I feel especially lucky. So value, you know, intimacy now. How could we have taken it so much for granted? You know, sometimes I wonder. But I see the suffering. I see the fear out there that many, many people not as lucky as me, and that eats away at me. I'll be glad when this thing is gone. I'm so glad to have a competent White House now. I think that's going to make a difference. And in terms of the personal challenges, it's the same ones we all face. How do you stay healthy in this? Get out every day and exercise. Try to do what I can and read a lot, write a lot. Work has been great. Just as we've been able to shift healthcare largely virtual, I'm having more meetings, I'm involved in more activities, I'm on more committees than ever before, so I have no complaints at all about that. So I hope you're well too, Bob. I know it's a hard time for everyone.
Same experience, hard, but very lucky, and the work seems almost never has it been more meaningful and interesting, really. You know, to think about all the dimensions of this problem, it's feels like I got a PhD in COVID over the past year. All of if you came at this as a clinician or as a social worker or as a politician or an economist, you had to learn about all of these other disciplines to make any sense of it. So that part's been gratifying, but I'll be thrilled when this thing is over.
your voice in this tough time has been very valuable. Bob, you've spoken out so well and so helpfully. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Don. It is always a joy to talk to you, and thank you for your work in COVID, and thank you for your work over your entire career. Really, more than anyone I can think of, you have made the healthcare system better and safer and more humane. So I'm grateful, and everybody out there should be.
It means a lot to me, Bob. Thank you so much.
A real thanks to Dr. Don Berwick for spending time with us. I just find Don just about the most thoughtful person I have had the luck to encounter and to work with in healthcare, and one of the most deeply moral people I have met. You know, it's been fascinating over the last 10 or 20 years. Don has recognized that just improving the healthcare system without improving the things that go into people's health, and many of them outside the healthcare system, many of them relate to poverty and education and social justice and criminal justice system, and all those things are absolutely crucial. And as Don recognized how important they were, it wouldn't be in him not to jump in and try to make a difference. So I think you heard that in the interview, learned a lot from talking to Don, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. We have some more fantastic episodes coming up on In the Bubble. We will do another episode of Safe or Not Safe, something we've done several times before with our guest epidemiologist, Caitlin Rivers from Johns Hopkins, and Farzad Mostashari. This will be Safe or Not Safe, a vaccine edition, where we spend a lot of our time talking about different situations, but when some people are vaccinated, some people aren't. Is it safe to get a haircut? Is it safe to see the dentist? Is it safe for grandparents to hug their grandchildren? And particularly when some are vaccinated, some are not. So it's really going to be a fascinating episode. Hope you have a chance to tune in. After that, we have a couple of other wonderful episodes coming up. Peter Hotez, who is one of the leading vaccinologists in the world. Peter's a professor at Baylor, will come on and talk to us about vaccines, including what we've learned about the Pfizer and Moderna, but also the new vaccines that are coming down the pike. We should have more of them approved in the next few weeks. And also this extraordinary high-stakes race that we're in between vaccines and variants. Peter has been all over the media talking about that, and we have a chance to chat with him for a while on the show in the next week or so. So you will enjoy that. And finally, a really wonderful episode with the Platt family. And the Platt family is this extraordinary family of people that have made a huge impact in the arts, particularly in the world of theater and movies. Mark Platt, the dad, has been nominated for a couple of Academy Awards, produced La La Land, produced Wicked on Broadway. His two sons, Jonah and Ben, are prominent actors. Ben has won the Tony Award for his performance in Dear Evan Hansen, is an extraordinarily accomplished and prominent singer, and has performed both on Broadway and in movies. And Jonah has had major theater performances as well. So we'll hear from them about what COVID has done to the arts and some of the backflips that the arts have had to do to try to keep some things running, including filming some movies during the pandemic. You'll hear about how they've managed to do that. So really interesting episode as we talk about the impact of COVID on an important part of all of our lives, and that is the arts and theater and movies. Lots of great stuff coming up, some other great shows after that. So please continue to tune in. Until then, stay safe, and I look forward to speaking with you soon. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McGowan produced our show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuryev. Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax executive produced the show. Our theme was composed by Dan Molad and Oliver Hill, and additional music by Ivan Kuryev. You can find out more about our show on social media at In the Bubble Pod. Until next time, stay safe and stay sane. Thanks so much for listening.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us on Archetypes, a dynamic podcast hosted by Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, as she digs into the labels that try to hold women back. In each intimate and candid conversation, Meghan is joined by guests like Serena Williams, Mariah Carey, Paris Hilton, Issa Rae, and Trevor Noah as they delve into the roots of countless common descriptors of women, like diva, crazy, dumb blonde, and the B word, and redefine and reclaim each identity along the way. The complete season of Archetypes is out now wherever you get your podcasts.